You're listening to the sounds of Mars, as recorded by Perseverance, the Mars rover. Perseverance is performing 250 million miles away, in temperatures as low as minus 153 degrees Celsius, operating smoothly, with Kestrel's liquid engineering in its veins and mechanisms. Kestrel is proud to have been chosen by NASA, having worked in space for over 60 years, including many of the pioneering Apollo missions and the International Space Station. And everything we do in space goes into everything we do here on Earth. In this podcast series, we will meet people and their machines who perform under some of our own planet's most extreme conditions on land, sea, and air. In this episode, we hear the unique stories of two astronauts whose determination to explore launched them into one of the most extreme environments of all.
We as astronauts living and working in space are only the tip of a super large monster and global iceberg that is working with us to solve whatever problems or challenges that we run into.
I saw in 1969, two people walk on the surface of the moon. And I was just a child then. And I sort of extrapolated and I thought, 69, put two people on the moon. 79, we'll have two people on Mars.
You know, a lot of people, when they have discussions about exploring space, have very strong opinions about, we should only send robots, or, robots aren't useful, you have to send humans. And the real answer is you need both, right? Because robots, there's several on Mars right now, as everyone's aware. And let's find out more about this planet before we send people there. I'm Dr. Sandra Magnus, and I am a former NASA astronaut and longtime aerospace professional. I've wanted to be an astronaut since I was a young girl, maybe 11 or 12 years old. I entered the astronaut office in 1996. It was everything I thought it would be and more. The training was not just the technical stuff, but I learned photography, I learned a little bit about emergency medicine, I learned how to fly a jet aircraft, and it was what I was born to do.
I am Dr. Robert Thirsk, and I am an astronaut. I had a huge opportunity a few years ago to fly on two space missions as a representative for Canada. First of all, a 17-day mission aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia, and then more recently, a six-month expedition aboard the International Space Station with international crewmates. The space station would not exist if Canadian Robotics was not there to support the assembly and the maintenance of the station. I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s, and whenever I had an opportunity, I would go to the school library and read all the magazines that had articles about the latest mission. I knew the lives, I knew the careers of all the Apollo astronauts and the Russian cosmonauts. In 1961, it was when the first human being, Yuri Gagarin, flew in space. And only 8 years later, two people walked on the moon. Mind blowing. You know, the space flights that I've been on have been challenging, and they absolutely have taken me to the limit of my physical, my mental, my emotional being. That hug that you give to each of your kids and your wife, that could be the last hug. But in order to minimize the risk, you really need to focus on the task, on that launch pad in the first hours as well. Launch is risky. Reentry is risky as well. Astronauts have a skill that we call compartmentalization, which means that we really focus on the task at hand. There are things that we need to do during launch. There are systems that we need to be monitoring. And if we see a malfunction or a contingency, there are actions that we need to take within seconds to save the spacecraft, to save the mission, to save our lives. So you really can't be thinking about family and friends.
We're just laying there, just waiting and waiting. T-minus 10 minutes, things start to really pick up. Time speeds up. We close and lock our visors. We're listening through our helmets, but we can also talk to each other over the air.
At the 9-minute mark, we come out of what we call a hold, and we're given the go for launch. And then the chit-chat stops. We have something that we call a sterile cockpit. So the conversation between us becomes very succinct. 6 seconds before liftoff, the shuttle's 3 main engines ignite. You begin to feel this creature coming alive. 0.3 of a second, the 2 solid rocket boosters ignite. And then at T equals 0, explosive charges, there's 8 of them that are holding the shuttle down to the launch pad. They explode. But you've just been sitting on your back for 2.5 hours. All of a sudden, bam, you got this force lifting you up. You really know you're going somewhere. The first 2 minutes are very loud, very powerful, and it's because of the solid rocket boosters. And 2 minutes, we jettison them. And the ride was very smooth, and it's like riding a Rolls Royce.
We can actually open our visors. About a minute before main engine cutoff, we start to feel 3 Gs through our chest. And so you're pinned in your seat. You know, you kind of have to talk like this to force air out of your lungs.
And it feels like there's 3 people sitting on your chest. You actually have to, you know, think about to expand your rib cage and get enough air into your lungs. And then at 8.5 minutes, we're in space. From a fraction of a second, we go from 3 Gs of acceleration to 0 Gs. Our limbs are flung forward in the deceleration. We undo our seat harness, and then we float up around the inside of the spaceship like Superman.
I let go of my checklist, and it stayed there floating in front of me, and I just giggled because it was so amazing. As the shuttle approaches the space station, it starts off as a tiny little point of light in the distance, like a big star. And as we get closer and closer, you can start to make out some of the features. So against the blackness of space behind it, you can start to see the solar arrays. As you get closer and you see it, and it's this monster building in space that you're going to go live on or visit, wow, this is such a testimony to what humans can do when we really, really decide we want to do something. And so then living there is an experience in that every day, because there's control centers all over the world. There's one in Moscow, there's one in Germany, there's one in Tokyo, there's 2 in the US. Our schedule of work is planned by this international working group, and they've learned with the space station that the schedule needs to be flexible, because you never know what's going to break today or what's not going to go well. But it could be anything from repair to robotics to spacewalks to science experiments to counting how many, you know, pairs of men underwear size large we have on the space station. Living in space is all about coming up with a closed system that's self-sustaining, which is why some of the technology, what we're doing in space, is going to help Earth achieve this. The mission that our crew had was to prepare the space station for a water regeneration system that would be able to take urine and condensate and other kind of dirty water and turn it into potable or drinking water. The water regeneration system didn't really work immediately at first, and so we did a lot of testing with it. That's what we trained for. We trained to fix all this kind of stuff. Going into the astronaut office, I had to learn how to use that part of my brain. Not everybody can flip their brain like that. Engineers tend to be a little bit of type A people, you know, making things and understanding how things work. And so there's a little bit of a control factor there. And so if you look at astronauts, we're sort of the type A of the type A's, because you have to be really disciplined and you have to be able to compartmentalize and multitask. As an operator, you have to actually take everything you've learned as how to think like an engineer and flip it upside down. So for example, I'm flying the T-38. We're in the air, you know, going a couple hundred miles an hour. I'm looking at all my instruments, got my helmet on to dub the noise. The radio might be talking. I'm watching the navigation and the guidance, controlling the plane. If my fire light goes on that says, hey, there might be a fire in the engine, the most important thing I want to know right now, is that a real fire? And what are my next immediate steps to make the situation safe? If I'm an engineer and I can only think like an engineer, I might immediately start diving down into, I wonder what thermocouple that is that actually caused the fire. As an operator, I don't care. I just care if it's real or not, because if it's real, I have to do something about it like now.
I think the astronauts do have fear, but you're going to laugh when I say this, but I think our greatest fear is a fear of screwing up. And that is there every day. And we really want to perform to a level of excellence. And making a mistake can be devastating for us. And if I make a mistake on orbit, I'm probably bummed out for the next day or two. I have to get over it quickly so I can get on and perform well for the next one.
What people can do that the robots cannot is react real time to the situation as it unfolds. Rovers are programmed. They could be on their journey from point A to point B to do X and pass by something super interesting that we would need to understand and explore further, but never know it because that's not what they've been programmed to do. A human could glance to the left and go, huh. Where AI and machine learning goes, I don't know, but at the moment, you need both. There really is a synergy between humans and robots going on different missions and even working together on one mission that is key to efficient and really productive exploration.
The exploration of space is being accomplished because of robots and also astronauts. Well, aboard the International Space Station, we also have a robot. It's called the Canadarm. And it has, just like a human arm, it has a shoulder, it has an elbow, and it has a wrist, and it has a hand. All of the modules, all of the truss work, all of the thermoradiators, all of the solar arrays were installed by the Canadarm2 on the space station. The most difficult task for me, we're going to take on a new task that had never been done prior on the International Space Station. That was to use the 17-meter-long robot arm to grapple a spacecraft that was hovering just below the station, grab it, and then dock it to a berthing point on the bottom side of the station. Now, this cargo vehicle was brand new. It was a Japanese one. It had never flown before. Previous cargo vehicles docked themselves in an automated mode using radar or using laser to dock in an automated fashion to a docking port. In order to do the grapple, we needed to turn the attitude control system off on the cargo vehicle. And as soon as you do that, it begins to slowly tumble away from the station and move away from the station. We had to do this quickly. We had to do it within 90 seconds. We were sweating bullets there. We were successful, but that probably took me to my limits on that particular flight. Astronauts, I think, have the best jobs in the world, but there's always a sacrifice that needs to be paid in the pursuit of a dream. When I launched the second time, my youngest son was 13 years old. And when I got back, his voice had dropped an octave. So that was pretty surprising to me. The first time he spoke to me, it's like I was speaking to a different individual. My wife will definitely say that I'm a different person after my two flights. In fact, my wife will say that I've never returned home from my second flight. And the first way that spaceflight changes you is you have a phenomenal appreciation for the beauty, but also the fragility of the planet that we live on.
One night, everybody else was sleeping. And we went over to the lab window, which is a great window for viewing the Earth. And we just spent an hour and a half listening to music and watching the world go by, because it takes us 90 minutes to go around the world. So 90 minutes was a complete revolution. To see how thin our atmosphere is, this thin eggshell of air that looks like you can just blow on it like dandelion fluff and it would, wander off into the universe. It's beautiful and terrifyingly fragile all at the same time. To see the planet as a closed system, one entity where everybody lives and understand by your very eyes that we're all connected, it was so awe-inspiring. We as astronauts living and working in space are only the tip of a super large monster in global iceberg. It's a program across 16 different countries, different languages, different political systems, different agendas, different types of engineering approaches, the English system and the metric system, you know, and we made it work. And it's there above our heads every day, a testimony to what we can do, the problems we can solve, the things we can achieve as humans when we want to work together. It's about the unknown, right? You think about just some simples, trying a new food or meeting a new person, reading a new book, visiting a new city. These are all expressions of exploring. It's about not knowing what's around the corner. It's about not knowing what's coming next. At the foundation of everything is change. Life is about change. We have to all learn to embrace our explorer and not let the fear stop you from doing things that help you grow as a human being and let you express your curiosity in ways that allow you to follow your passion and follow your interests.
There's a number of moving appendages on board a space station, the Canadarm robotic arm, for example, but also the solar rays that need to continually point to the sun, thermal radiators that need to continually point toward deep space, an antenna that need to point to antenna on the ground as well. They're all moving parts and moving appendages, and their job is made possible by lubricants that allow them to keep turning incessantly and continually.
Jennifer Campbell, National Account Manager. Castrol's relationship with NASA goes back almost 60 years, back to the Apollo missions. We've been a part of all the shuttle missions, the International Space Station, the Hubble Telescope, and as well as all the Mars rovers. On the International Space Station, Castrol lubricants are used predominantly on the exterior. So the Brakeout 602EF is used on the Solar Alpha rotary joint, and the 602EF is also used on the Canadarm to provide the lubrication in the mechanisms. And through the years, because of our heritage and the fact that it's proven that these lubricants, the Brakeout and Brakeout products, work in space applications, we have continued our relationship with NASA through the Apollo missions, the Space Shuttle program, all the Mars rovers, and hopefully a lot more in the future as we move farther and farther away from our planet.
So thank you to Castrol for being a part of human spaceflight exploration. Without lubrication, there's a number of systems aboard spacecraft that just would not operate. So thank you.
You're listening to the Castrol on Mars podcast series. Everything we do in space goes into everything we do here on Earth. Find out more at castrol.com/onmars.